Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak. I want to thank you for joining us. This is a special presentation we're doing today. I want to play for you an extraordinary excerpt, a speech by Thomas Drake, who is a national security whistleblower, and he's got some things to say that are very, very important. And before we do that, though, I want to tell you about some events coming up. Today, April 18th, there's a vigil for Medicaid expansion, and the coalition is doing this. This is 11 a.m. at State Representative Hager's office. That's 301 Yamada Road in Boca Raton. On the 19th, tomorrow, there's a Health Care for Florida Now rally, Planned Parenthood, and that is at 10:30 a.m. at the Planned Parenthood Administration Office. North Florida Mango Road, West Palm Beach. On the 20th, Remember the Dreamer, Musical Moments at the Monument. That's the MALK Junior Coordinating Committee, and that's at the MALK Memorial Site, 2400 North Flagler in West Palm Beach. On the 20th, there's a press conference rally to protest Marco Rubio's vote against background checks. On the 21st, there's a Boycott Kellogg GMO Honk and Wave Consumer Education Coalition, and that's 11 a.m. at Costco. Boycott Kellogg, that's because of Kellogg's use of genetic modified material in what is sold as food. And that's at 1873 Lantana Road, Lantana, Florida. On the 21st, Films for Thought, there's a Do the Math, that's the Facts of Climate Change, Move On Council, and that's at noon at Grizzy's Coffee Shop in Delray Beach. Also on the 21st, there's an Awake Coalition meeting. That's 3 p.m. at the SEIU. And at that meeting, that'll be at 2112 South Congress Avenue, Palm Springs. And on the 27th, Workers' Memorial Day, that's at Palm Beach Treasure Coast AFL-CIO from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Roxy Pub. That's 309 Clematis Street, West Palm Beach. That's to remember all those we've lost to workplace injuries and illness. And for those sequesterites who want to cut back on regulation, there'll be more and more people hurt in workplace injuries. So let's remember them on the 27th of April. In fact, we're going to have Chrissy Casada talk a little bit more about that. So stick around. There's more to come. And I do also want to mention that this Sunday, the 21st, we're doing an all-nuclear show. We've got information from the Caldecott Symposium on Fukushima and Chernobyl and the long, long shadow they both cast. So make sure you tune in Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. On the 1st of May, at the there's an event called Social Security, Medicaid, and the Budget by the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicaid. That's at 10 a.m. at Temple Emeth at 5780 West Atlantic Avenue in Delray Beach. There's a direct action training on May 1st of Everglades Earth First. and location and details will be announced later. Also on the 1st, International Workers' Day rally, Move On Council, North Broward, South Palm Beach, at the corner of Atlantic and Swinton in Delray Beach at 4 o'clock. On May 5th, an Awake Coalition meeting, 3 p.m., at the Iron Workers Hall, 1001 West 15th Street, Riviera Beach. It's really great to see the activist community union people coming together again. It's such a wonderful thing. It gives us hope and strength as we face the one percenters. On May 18th, the day before Mother's Day, is a Mother's Day for Peace action, and that's put on by Code Pink, South Florida, Raging Grannies, and WILPF, and that's 2 p.m. City Place, downtown West Palm Beach. May 19th, Films for Thought, Broken on All Sides, the Prison Industrial Complex. Okay, one of our first news items. People have staged demonstrations in Washington to protest against the United States' use of assassination drones. Protesters gathered outside the White House as they chanted slogans and held signs against Washington's use of drones. Saturday's protest is part of a public protest dubbed April's Actions. And organizers say they're going to spread this nationwide and target the infrastructure, military bases, universities, and companies that support U.S. government overseas drone programs. The activists want President Obama to abandon his assassination drone program. U.S. officials refuse to publicly discuss any details of the Kavod program, and the death toll from drone strikes remains a mystery, as does so much of foreign policy. According to the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, in Pakistan alone, 366 strikes have killed up to 3,581 people, with 884 being innocent civilians. Washington uses assassination drones in several countries, claiming that they target terrorists, although according to witnesses, the attacks have been mostly led to massive civilian casualties. There's a rising concern of Euro-digital rights. This is a story from the Brussels Bureau of the IDGN News Service, IDG. More than 80 European digital rights organizations on Wednesdays called on the European Commission to do more than protect net neutrality. The groups represented by the European Consumer Association and the European Digital Rights Group are demanding an end to dangerous experimentation with the functions of the Internet in Europe. The group said in an open letter to the Commission that operators across Europe are violating Internet neutrality, particularly in the mobile sector, where they said there is evidence that companies, including ISPs, are using technical measures for their own commercial interests and tampering with the citizens' ability to access the Internet. Experimentation by certain European access providers with blocking, filtering, and throttling of services creates borders in an online world where key value is the absence of borders, said Joe McNamee, executive director of EDRI, in a statement demanding the European Commission put a stop to it. BEUC and EDRI fear that the upcoming non-binding recommendations on net neutrality from the Commission will be based on what they deem to be meaningless safeguards, such as the possibility to switch operators and the obligation for each operator to have at least one full Internet offer. Digital Agenda Commissioner Nellie Kroes has been a vocal advocate of net neutrality, saying that consumers should be free to make their own choice about their Internet subscription and online activity, but this does not preclude customers from subscribing to more differentiated, limited Internet offers, possibly for a lower price. Digital rights organizations La Quadrille du Net claimed in January that Kroes had caved into telecom operator pressure and was giving up on net neutrality. She replied she would not be bullied by NGOs or by lobbyists. Make no mistake, she said, I'm in favor of an open Internet and maximum choice that must be protected. But you don't need me or the EU to tell you what sort of Internet services you must pay for, said Kroes. The commissioner has initiated many consultations on net neutrality and has asked European national legislators and regulators to wait for better evidence before regulating on a country-by-country basis. However, both Netherlands and Slovenia, reluctant to wait, have already introduced legal protections for net neutrality. Okay, and now let's find ourselves Mr. Thomas Aldecott. Here we go. Meanwhile, let me put some music on while I find that next selection.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun.
And that was Bing Crosby singing that old tune from the Depression era, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Okay, so I've got the Thomas Drake section ready, and let me turn you on to Thomas Drake, whistleblower, former NSA researcher.
2 years ago, our guest today was accused by the U.S. Justice Department of espionage. The Air Force veteran and longtime senior executive at the National Security Agency was accused of giving classified documents to a news reporter. Thomas Drake faced 35 years in prison. A year later, on the eve of his trial, the government dropped all felony charges against Mr. Drake. He has since been honored as a whistleblower who helped to expose waste and fraud at the spy agency and to bring to light its massive effort to spy on Americans' own citizens. Mr. Drake's ordeal began coincidentally on September 11, 2001, which happened to be his first day as a full-time employee of the NSA. Like all other U.S. intelligence agencies, the NSA had missed key pieces of information that might have tipped off the government that the terrorist attacks were imminent. Shortly after 9/11, Mr. Drake came to believe that the agency could have predicted the attacks if it had made use of a surveillance system known as Thin Thread that could sift through massive amounts of data and detect patterns and key information. Instead, NSA leaders turned to outside contractor SAIC to build a new data collection system called Trailblazer that cost more than $1 billion, 10 times the cost of Thin Thread. At the same time, Mr. Drake learned that the agency was turning its surveillance capabilities on American citizens, which he believed was a violation of the U.S. Constitution. He decided to speak up. Mr. Drake reported his concerns about money wasted on Trailblazer and about domestic surveillance to Congress and to the Defense Department's Inspector General. He became a material witness in two 9/11 congressional investigations. Even after the Inspector General found that the Trailblazer project was a massive waste and the program was killed, little changed at the NSA. Mr. Drake then decided to go public. He brought his information about the problems with Trailblazer to a Baltimore Sun reporter who wrote a series of articles exposing the waste. Mr. Drake insists he did not reveal any classified information. Yet, when the New York Times in 2005 reported the stunning news that the U.S. government was tapping into its citizens' telephone calls with no warrants, Mr. Drake became a target in one of the most aggressive leak investigations in history. Agents raided his home in 2007, took his computers and files, and threatened that he could spend the rest of his life in prison. In 2010, the Justice Department indicted Mr. Drake for, quote, willful retention of classified documents. It was only the fourth time in history that a citizen was charged with espionage for mishandling documents. A conviction could have had a chilling effect on whistleblowers and on journalists who often receive and keep defense documents. Morton Halperin of the Open Society Institute said Mr. Drake's prosecution, quote, poses a grave threat to the mechanism by which we learn what the government does. Instead, the government's case fell apart when the government found no evidence that Mr. Drake willfully leaked classified information. Mr. Drake's sentencing judge said the prosecution was, quote, not proper. It does not pass the smell test. Thomas Drake now writes, speaks, and teaches about whistleblowing, constitutional rights, and abuse of government power. He's the recipient of the 2011 Ridenour Truth-Telling Prize and the 2011 Sam Adams Associates Integrity and Excellence Award. As we wrap up Sunshine Week here at the National Press Club, please help me give a warm welcome to Thomas Drake.
I'd like to thank the National Press Club for inviting me here. I'm looking forward to the Q&A, so I do have a few remarks to kind of set the tone and the tenor and to reflect quite in a sobering manner on what happened to me and what's at stake for this country. I've entitled my remarks, In the Shadowlands of the Secrecy State, Preying on the First Amendment. I first want to announce, however, that I can neither confirm nor deny that a solar eclipse cast by the shadow government is at least partially blocking the view of Sunshine Week. To do either might just reveal state secrets to reporters and journalists, including those of you in the room, unauthorized to receive them. And I would not want you all to end up with allegedly classified information regarding the weather in Washington, D.C. The White House blog on Wednesday said, quote, we celebrate Sunshine Week, an appropriate time to discuss the importance of open government and freedom of information, including a quote from President Obama saying, quote, openness will strengthen our democracy and promote efficiency and effectiveness in government. Really? Jocelyn Radak, the National Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project, remarked on Twitter just yesterday that after, quote, 3 years of shouting into the wilderness, unquote, she is relieved to see the Kool-Aid crowd is finally realizing that the Obama administration's draconian orgy of secrecy is finally reaching a boiling point. Glenn Greenwald with the Guardian newspaper published a very powerful article yesterday titled, quote, Obama's secrecy fixation causing Sunshine Week implosion. I'd like to remind everybody that President John F. Kennedy said that the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. I'd like to think that we have reached a critical event horizon, and whether national security as a new state religion will further suck the dwindling light of the First Amendment into the black hole of classification and secrecy hidden from public view. It seems that secrecy is actually strengthening the national security state in order to hide from accountability and oversight at the expense of informed public interest, where it matters the most. What is the price of keeping the public in the dark and having a government increasingly operating in the dark through secret law or interpretations in secret of existing law? After all, this very event is part of Sunshine Week, and I would like to highlight just one event that brings the message of Sunshine Week home regarding what's so at stake and our increasingly two-faced government. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee held hearings this week on addressing transparency in the federal bureaucracy, moving toward a more open government. The larger theme of the testimony before that committee centered on the inherent tension between the president's pledge for a new era of unprecedented openness and a record of invoking threats to national security to keep the public in the dark time and time again. The written testimony, and here I give a shout out to the Project on Government Oversight and their POGO blog, states, quote, there seems to be two Obama administrations, two American governments, really. One looks like a democracy in which an open government accountable to the people is an ideal and a priority. And the other is a national security state where claims of national security often trump democratic principles such as a people's right to know, civil liberties, freedom of speech, and whistleblower protections. Of course, this is not an approach exclusive to this president, but the unchecked secrecy of Obama's national security state is at cross purposes with many of his administration's openness objectives and it raises doubts about the president's commitments and declarations about transparency, unquote. So given where we are today at the National Press Club, it seems to me that it's more than appropriate for us to discuss the long shadow of government secrecy obscuring the view of democracy in our constitutional republic, or what's left of it. Threats to the First Amendment by the government is bullseye centered on a free and unfettered press designed to suppress and repress speech and political expression in America, create fear through unilateral authority and privilege over what is fit or unfit for the First Amendment. If speech becomes the instrument of crime when revealing government crime and wrongdoing, we are under arbitrary authoritarian rule and not the rule of law. In our post-9/11 world, the government is increasingly in the First Un-Amendment business, engaged in a direct assault on free speech and the very foundation of our democracy, because our very individual freedoms have now become fair game for the secrecy regime, all in the name and under the mantle and cloak called national security. In fact, I can make an argument that government increasingly prefers to operate in the shadows and finds the First Amendment a constraint on its activities. And yet, taking off the veil of government secrecy has more often than not turned truth tellers and whistleblowers into turncoats and traitors, who are then often criminally burned, blacklisted, and broken by the government on the stake of national security. Egregious violations of the Fourth Amendment, many still occurring in secret far beyond the awareness and knowledge of most Americans, are eroding and chipping away the First Amendment. For example, the Patriot Act, along with a number of other enabling acts, including the recently reauthorized FISA Amendments Act, plus many more, including massive abuse of CALEA, ECPA, and CFAA, are now blunt-end instruments of a Homeland Security and surveillance apparatus that legalizes government deception, citizen monitoring, and wrongdoing, while those who reveal government wrongdoing, illegality, and embarrassment are often prosecuted and increasingly indicted for speaking truth to power. I know. I knew too much truth and exposed government illegalities, fraud, and abuse, and was turned into a criminal for doing so. I was charged under the Espionage Act, faced many years in prison, and became an enemy of the state. It was 5 years of living under the boot of the surveillance state. And yet, I was saved by the First Amendment and the court of public opinion and the free press, including the strength and growing resiliency of the alternative media, the very cornerstone of all of our liberties and freedoms, the one on which all the rest rely, the active voice and conscience of the Constitution of the United States of America. Freedom means everything to me, and especially when I face the prospect of having all my freedoms taken away from me and placed under all kinds of restrictions in movement and monitored activity for several years. So for the sake of our common future and the country we want to keep, we must ask of ourselves some very hard questions. Is the First Amendment becoming a casualty in an indefinite, undeclared war where notions of a free press, public interest, and informed citizenry get in the way of national security interests defined in secret? In our wired and wireless world, what happens to anonymous speech and the press on the internet when the government has a persistent dragnet surveillance system in place, the emergence of a virtual Orwellian state? Do we really want the government listening in on and tracking the lives of so many others? Have our constitutional freedoms become the latest victims of 9/11? Is the intolerance shown by the secret federal government for the magnificent, of our precious First Amendment freedoms, a foreboding of things to come. Will national security replace our individual rights? Will fear take priority over freedom? Will government censorship and propaganda triumph over personal choice and disclosure? Is suppression repression the instrument for stamping out dissent? Will government embarrassment extinguish exposure? Is the tree of liberty becoming an endangered species? And if we starve liberty for the increasingly myopic sake of security, what will we have left to defend? What happens when the acid of secrecy and suppression erode the very bedrock of the First Amendment? What happens when the sources of what is really happening in government increasingly choose not to speak to the press? What happens when we increasingly self-censor ourselves and the news is not fit to print because it invites undue government attention? How else will the press report the real news when their sources dry up and the government becomes a primary purveyor of its own news? It is our freedom of choice that is at stake as citizens, and not the government's to just take away from us in secret under the guise of keeping us safe from ourselves. We must now rescue the Constitution from our very own government before it becomes a hollow shell of its former self. The rights we have, the rights, not privileges, the rights we have under the First Amendment are the living blueprint and beacon for our personal freedoms and power of choice. George Orwell said, quote, "If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear," unquote. When there is no transparency, openness, or public accountability for the deeds of government, including secret surveillance, torture, kill lists, the cover the AUMF used to justify our foreign policy, abandonment of due process, FOIA redactions and delays, prosecutorial overreach and misconduct, only invites further abuse, secret rule, and unchecked power by the government. What happens to our country? What happens to our country when laws are secretly reinterpreted behind closed doors by government officials who prefer to operate in the shadows without public debate, but promote and support laws that violate the privacy and protections afforded by the Constitution for the sake of national security? So are we willing to forsake our liberties for the sake of security, when in fact it is our very liberties which define the heart and core of our national security? What is more pernicious in terms of a freedom of the press and an informed citizenry when the very sources are threatened with life in prison for simply telling the truth about the government? You see, the First Amendment of all the amendments is an invaluable protection for public freedom against government overreach and intrusion into our lives, our fortunes, and our very futures. Do we want to let the First Amendment join the list of endangered species, where the remaining descendants end up in a zoo somewhere behind a cage for people to come and gawk? As Kevin Gustola, a remarkable investigative reporter with Fire Dog Lake, said just yesterday in his article, quote, "What is worse? A powerful person telling citizens they have no right to know because they fervently believe that all hell will break loose if they allow any transparency, or a powerful person who purports to favor transparency and openness telling citizens they do not have a right to know because he or she is not that powerful person who has contempt for open government," unquote. In an open and transparent society, the citizenry are supposed to know the truth of its own government. So if the First Amendment is the sunshine of our liberty, how else are we to remain free if the government casts its shadows over you and me?
I understand that your activism extends beyond merely helping human rights issues. I understand you're also involved in helping to feed the homeless.
I am involved in, I am involved in feeding the homeless, and I also work with a food bank that we give out food on Wednesday.
Oh, that's really nice. You know, I understand from our good friends at Food Not Bombs that they've actually been involved in some altercations with law enforcement because some communities would prefer that the hungry starve than be fed.
Well, I'm really not surprised about that. I think a lot of people are more interested in their perception of their neighborhoods than they are actually worried about feeding hungry or underprivileged people, bringing clothes, giving, I also work with another place that we give out personal hygienic items to people that are homeless. And, you know, hey, nobody wants to be bothered with those people in their neighborhood.
It just seems to me such a shame that a country as great as ours, with all the resources that we have, should see hungry, homeless people and especially turn them away when they're hungry.
I agree, Rick. You know, a lot of this is about awareness, perception. I can't understand why people are the way they are. I had thought when the economic difficulties reached so far into our own pockets that a lot of people would relate more to the fact that, hey, it doesn't matter if you've worked all your lives, where you came from, what educational background that you have, that we could all fall on hard times and may need a little help getting back up. But I don't know. That just did not tend to happen this time.
Well, Debbie, hold on 1 second. I'm going to run back into the studio, and I'll be there with you in the studio in just a moment.
Thank you, Rick.
We're doing some experimental radio today, and it's something that those of us at Progressive News Network try to do on a regular basis. I do want to mention a couple things once again. Our good friends in the Progressive Broadcast community have a really wonderful set of different programs and projects available to you, and I hope you tune in not only to this show, but you tune in to Gwen Holden Berry and her show There Be Monsters. We hope you tune in to Susan Nylon and her show, The Nylon Report. We also hope that you tune in to Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women. And also Sita Vidul with her show. She's up the coast in the Melbourne area. And, of course, our good friend Brian Stetton with his show, Progress Toward Democracy. A wonderful array of programs that you can hear good progressive opinion. And also, our good friend Bob Abston is going to be probably guest hosting for me this Sunday on the Nuclear Show. We have a real incredible array of talent. We're going to have presentations by Dr. Lynn Rydenberg. Let's see here. She's going to be talking about the Ringenberg. That's it. Lynn Ringenberg, who's going to give us her perspective from Physicians for Social Responsibility. And we've also got presentations by Mary Olson, who's going to talk about the variation. It seems, and I've never heard this talked about before, it seems that radiation has a different impact on women and children than it does on men. And if you think about it for a second, the point that she's made, as in her studies, is that because women have so much, should we say, cell growth through their reproductive system, with the constant rebuilding and changing of cells in their reproductive system, that they're very susceptible since there's so much active cell growth. Same thing true of children. The children are impacted. And it seems that when the original post-World War II, projects of Little Man and Big Boy, the World War II atomic bombs, those tests and those standards were set by having young men in the prime of life briefly exposed to radiation. And those standards were never adjusted, except up, curiously enough, were never adjusted to consider the varying impact on women and children. And it's very unfortunate. So you hear about that from Miss Mary Olson. Also, you're going to hear a presentation by S. Dave Freeman, who has been involved in nuclear power and power generation literally back to those days at Alamogordo. And he's going to talk about not just the history of nuclear power and its commercial application, its impact on power distribution, but he's also going to talk about different strategies that he thinks are important for us to consider as we oppose what we're going to call the sloppy workmanship and corporate science that right now is running roughshod in the nuclear industry. We're going to hear from a Polish scientist, Vladimir Vorlecki. He's going to talk about the medical aspects of genetics and how that relates to problems that still persist from Chernobyl. And when people think about nuclear power and the radiation dangers, they tend to think of, well, you know, within a human lifespan, well, it's going to take many years for the radiation to subside. the half-life of radioactive poison, or half-life of radioactive waste, is not a lifetime or two of human beings. We're talking about tens of thousands of years, and there is as yet no actually way of dealing with the waste. Let me pause for a moment. I'm going to play you a little excerpt from Senator Warren, and this is her talking to some banking regulators. She's really pulling for us, one of the few people in government right now who's very engaged with challenging business as usual. This is Senator Warren interviewing a bank regulator.
Let me just make sure I understand this completely. I want to know on a bank-by-bank basis the number of families that were illegally foreclosed on. Will you give me that information?
Eventually, we were going to issue a statement to the public where we provide additional information, but if we go through the processes that I described previously, we can share it to Congress in its oversight capacity.
So you're saying you will make that information publicly available?
I did not say that. I said that we're planning on issuing a public statement that wraps up the IFR and
that's
provides additional information.
That's not what I'm asking for.
Yeah.
What I'm asking for is a bank-by-bank analysis of how many families they illegally foreclosed on. Will you give us that information?
We can provide that to Congress in its oversight capacity if we go through the normal processes that we're prepared to follow.
And why are you not making that public? I just want to make sure I understand.
I don't know that there's been a decision not to. I think that we're still evaluating what we're going to release publicly.
Are you claiming that the information about illegal activity is privileged and confidential?
It's all part of it is all confidential supervisory information, but that does not mean that we won't at some point release some of that information. That decision just hasn't been made at this point.
So you're saying when you find evidence of illegal activities by the banks, when they have illegally foreclosed against homeowners, that information is privileged and you will not release it without a letter from Congress?
If it is derived from the bank examination process, yes, it is.
How else would you get it?
Well, sometimes you get information through third parties, through outside sources, but in this case, that's not
the case. Unless someone throws a rock through the window with this information tied to it, you will not release it? Is that what you're saying?
To the extent that the information is confidential supervisory information derived from the exam process, it is subject to privilege. We don't ordinarily make that public. However, in this case, we do plan on making public issuances describing further findings and further analysis of the process.
On a bank-by-bank basis of illegal activity?
I don't know if that's been determined yet.
All right, so let me ask it from the other point of view. You now have evidence in your files of illegal activity, I take it, for some of these banks. I get that from the evidence you've released about the charts, who's going to get paid what. So if someone believes that they have been illegally foreclosed against, will they still have a right under this settlement to bring a lawsuit against the bank?
Yes.
All right. Now, if a family wants to bring the lawsuit, you're both lawyers, would it be helpful, if you're going against one of these big banks, would it be helpful for these families to have the information about their case that's in your files? Mr.
Yes.
Ashton?
It would be helpful, obviously, to have information related to the injury. Yes, it would.
Okay. So do you plan to give the families this information? That is, those families that have been victims of illegal foreclosures, will you be giving them the information that's in your possession about how the banks illegally foreclosed against them? Mr. Ashton?
I think that's a decision that we're still considering. We haven't made a final decision yet.
So you have made a decision to protect the banks, but not a decision to tell the families who were illegally foreclosed against?
We haven't made a decision about what information we would provide to individuals. That's true, yes.
Mr. Stepana?
We're in the same position.
So I just want to make sure I get this straight. Families get pennies on the dollar in this settlement for having been the victims of illegal activities or mistakes in the bank's activities. You let the banks, And you now know individual cases where the banks violated the law, and you're not going to tell the homeowners, or at least it's not clear yet whether or not you're going to do that.
We haven't made a decision on what we're going to tell the homeowners.
You know, I just have to say, I thought this was about transparency. That's what this is all about. People want to know that their regulators are watching out for the American public, not for the banks. And the only way that we can evaluate whether or not you're doing your job is if you make some of this information publicly available. And so far, you're not doing that. And without transparency, we can't have any confidence either in your oversight or that the markets are functioning properly at all. So, and that people are going to receive proper compensation for what went wrong.
Yep, that's right. They don't really plan on telling the Americans when the banks really took complete advantage of them and foreclosed, you know, without the right to do that. Why would they do that, I wonder? Oh, that's right. There are regulators protecting us, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. This is from the latest news in grist.org. There's a new study. Fukushima meltdown correlates to hyperthyroidism in American infants. For those of you who have the illusion that the Fukushima radiation is really only impacting the Japanese, you are mistaken. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but when they started detecting radiation in the tuna fish off California and the kelp off of California, they stopped monitoring. Clears that up. No problem now. And remember, the important phrase that pays is no immediate danger. And there's a variation, no imminent danger, but essentially they're the same. In other words, don't worry about it. Just move along. Fallout from Fukushima meltdown a couple years back, it's not just the Japanese who are suffering, though their plight is obviously the worst. Radioactive isotopes blasted from the failed reactors may have given kids born in Hawaii and along the American West Coast health disorders, which, if left untreated, can lead to permanent mental and physical handicaps. Children born in Alaska, California, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington between 1 week and 16 weeks after the meltdown began in March of 2011 were 28% more likely to suffer from congenital hyperthyroidism than were kids born in those states during the same period 1 year earlier, a new study shows. This is research. This isn't faith healing, friends. This is actual scientific data. In the rest of the U.S., during that period in 2011, when the radioactive fallout was less severe, the risk actually decreased slightly compared with last year. Substantial quantities of radioisotope iodine-131 were produced by the meltdown and then wafted over the Pacific Ocean and fell over Hawaii and the American West Coast and other Pacific countries in rain and snow, reaching levels hundreds of times greater than those considered safe. After entering our bodies, radioactive iodine gathers in our thyroid. The thyroid are glands that release hormones and control how we grow. Babies, including those not yet born, such radiation can stunt the development of brain and body. The condition known as congenital hyperthyroidism. It's treatable when detected early. Fukushima fallout may affect areas all over the United States, and especially in some mostly western parts of the nation, wrote researchers in the Radiation and Public Health Project in their peer-reviewed paper published in the Open Journal of Pediatrics. Of course, there's no immediate danger. New York Times, a new leak was found this April 15th. A new leak found in the Fukushima power plant. Efforts to remove highly contaminated water from leaking underground storage pool at the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant were delayed on Sunday when the plant's operator said it had found yet another leak, this time in the pipes that would be used to move water to above-ground storage containers. While small, the newest leak will force TEPCO to postpone removal of water from number 2 storage pool for several days while the company repairs the faulty pipe junction. The pool has spilled some 32,000 gallons of radioactive water and appears to be leaking. Now, the radioactive water that's leaked into the nearby bay has gotten the bay so contaminated that they've actually sealed off the bay with the vague hopes that they're going to somehow impact and limit the leaks. But in fact, they can't. Also, you may be aware they recently had a very high, intense earthquake in that area. That's way back on the 17th of April, which many of you may know was yesterday. Okay, It's an intense level 6 that hit northeast Japan. That's an older one. Okay. Also, you should know that that sinkhole in Louisiana is growing. I'm always happy to hear that. I guess that's less environment we have to be worried about. The containment system, the primary means of keeping the oil and the briny water feeding into the sinkhole from below and from infiltrating surrounding cypress forests and scenic bayous. It was designed lifespan of at least 20 years, the Texas brine officials said in their recorded statement. The Office of Conservation Officials said in a written response to questions that the sinkhole is likely to widen and become more shallow over time, even after periodic tremors end, but the hole itself isn't likely to go anywhere. I guess those holes seldom walk away. Imagine that. Conservation said they remain in emergency response mode and have yet set no endpoint for it. Conservation officials also said that over the long term, I guess they mean centuries, they were asked about a span of hundreds to thousands of years, the sinkhole is likely to fill in or become indistinguishable from the land rest. So those of you with all of you. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us for this brief little episode. We wanted to bring you that Thomas Drake piece. It's very critical. Also, watch for the Chrissy Quesada from the AFL-CIO coming up. And also, we're going to have a special report from Summer Gentry on a public response that's wanted on the overreach of the TSA. And don't forget, tune in this Sunday. It's the All Fukushima Show with reports from the Caldecott Symposium. I'm your host, Rick Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. And my co-host today, briefly, is Miss Debbie Fraser. Debbie, say nighty-night.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll join us again real soon when Progressive News Network brings you the news that you're seldom likely to hear on even our good friends in PR. So thanks so much for joining us, and you have a good day. I insist.
There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see?